Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We do come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And we stream live at richarddugan.com during those radio broadcast times. We archive the podcasts on the radio shows page at richarddugan.com as well as on SoundCloud and iTunes. And we are, at least for the present, we are on Facebook and Twitter. And we encourage you also to go to our guests link. We have that as part of both the schedules page as well as the radio shows page, which would be up there. And then when you go to SoundCloud and you're listening to the interview, the guest's name is listed there. It is a link to the guest's website. So please avail yourself of the information that's available today. Ordinarily, I would say today is going to be one fun program. I am really looking forward to having some exciting conversations. And you know what? I really am, because I'm looking forward to the conversation we're going to have with my guest, Edie Nathan. And it is, well, I'm going to use the contraction because that's part of the title. It's grief. The dance of self-discovery through trauma and loss. And Edie, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. And of course, people are going, "You're an idiot, Richard. What do you mean fun and excitement on a program?" Well, that's the interesting thing about this. If I am understanding, I was reading an article in regards to this whole aspect of going ahead and I'm going to use one of Robert Bly's words from his book, Iron John. You have got to go to that place they call catabasis, or, if you will, the bottom, the end of it all, so to speak, in order to come back out. And if I'm correct also, we've got to find ways of expressing our grief in a healthy way when it comes to loss. And we're not just talking about the loss of a loved one, whether it be human or animal. We're talking about the loss of anything that is meaningful to us, a job, a place that we live. I mean, I live in Southern California, Central California, with all these fires. Thankfully, haven't lost the home I live in yet. And I rent. So, you know, I'd have to find a new place to rent, but you know, all my earthly possessions would be gone. Hopefully not the animals. But isn't that really what we're going to be talking about here, is finding that place of, if the right word is equanimity, if you will, or balance in our lives, where it's okay to cry, it's okay to grieve, it's okay to get angry. I had a dear friend who passed away in our home. And 3 days after his passing, my wife and I were lying in bed, and I couldn't believe where the anger that I was so mad. I was so angry that he left. I couldn't figure out where in the world that came from. Is that what we're talking about?
That is exactly what we're talking about. And the experience that you just shared of not knowing where the anger is coming from, that's exactly the experience of grief. We don't know the emotions that are going to come up, and we're often surprised by those emotions, and they actually fit right into what I call the 11 phases of grief. And you know, I know that people have spoken about the stages, and in the stages they're kind of finite. You go through 1, 2, 3, 4, and actually what makes me kind of stand out in this conversation around grief and the phases is that I see it as a dance. I see that you are going to move in and out of these emotions. So the first emotion might be anger and rage, and the reasons behind the anger and rage: you lost someone, you can't control it, you can't change it. And there you are really feeling the intensity and the darkness of the loss and the depth of that. And in our culture, we've silenced grief. We try to remedy it sometimes through medication, sometimes through alcohol. People around us want us to get over it. I don't know if getting over it is more for them or for you, to be honest with you. So it's grief is, it's everywhere. And if someone loses someone or loses a pet or loses a job or loses a limb, the degree that they grieve is going to be different for sure. It's not for me to say, oh, it's right or wrong how you grieve, but it's grief. Everyone's going to go through it in their way, and it will have its potency depending on what you've lost and how you have handled previous losses.
So are you saying to us that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's four stages of grief, you've expanded upon that? That, I mean, they're still valid, but it's there's more depth there that we need to look at?
So I trained with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I mean, I took a couple of week-long intensives with her, with a lot of people. And the beauty of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is she got us talking about death and dying in ways that we never had. When she initially brought up the four or five stages of grief, she was actually talking about the grief that the dying went through. And, you know, the bargaining was really about the dying bargaining for life. What I'm talking really more about the grief and the survivors than the person who is dying. And, you know, we are all dying a little bit every day for sure. And therefore, you know, our grief hits us in many different ways. So what she was really talking about was the dying. And I'm talking about, how are we going to live with our grief? How are we going to move with it? How are we going to really be in the darkness? And I have a quote from a wonderful writer. She wrote a poem called The Initiation. Her name is Araya Mountain Dreamer. And she, the quote at the end of the poem is, "I want to know if you can be alone with yourself and if you truly like the company you keep in the empty moments." And that's what grief and the journey of grief actually asks you to do, is meet yourself. And learn who you are as you're facing the obstacles presented by grief. And there is no greater teacher, or at least one of the greatest teachers, is grief, because it will teach you things about yourself that you may have never known, what you can tolerate, and maybe who your friends are, or maybe who new people that come into your life and welcoming them. So it's a learning process, if you dare.
If you dare. I know some people don't. They almost treat it as if they have a restraining order against that person that they're supposed to be communicating with and connecting with themselves. And that's why they don't. I can tell you that a dear friend of my wife's, when my wife was going through her bout of surgery and chemotherapy back in 2001, she hung around for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, and then just disappeared. It was like she dropped off the face of the map, tried to get a hold of her, and I didn't know this, my wife did, that of course she, this friend, her mother had gone through terminal illness, and I said, there's nothing wrong with you, because my wife took it on. You know, she's very empathic as well, but she took it on and thinking there was something wrong with her, and I said, no. If what you're telling me is true, she, your friend, she couldn't handle it. It was too much for her. And she couldn't be around someone she thought she was going to lose who, if you want to look at it this way, cared about you that much. In one sense, by the same token, if she really cared, some would say, well, if she really cared, she would have stuck around. It's a tough one, and there's no question about it. I remember when my first wife came off of the airplane, walking down the steps with her first guide dog, and I knew that in 10 or 12 years, this dog was going to be taken away, because they usually don't let you keep the dog after its period of service when they are reached its prime. And I said, I'm not going to get close to this dog. No way. I'm just, because I don't want to face that. Well, the reality was, I did. I mean, how are you going to not? I mean, they're living there in the home with you. But as my father once said, eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because nobody gets out of this world alive. Well, for those of us who are alive today, that's true. And those of us who have experienced the loss of a loved one, and I'm grateful that my father and my mother are still alive in their mid-late 80s, I know that day is coming. I know I'm going to get that phone call, and then I'm going to have to figure out what to do. I mean, I live here in Santa Barbara, and I'm thinking, do I go back to Phoenix for them? They're gone. Or am I going back for my siblings? Or am I going back for me? And I think that's the struggle we all have with if we have to travel a distance following the passing. And I want to have you address this a little bit because I know this is part of the process as well. It's like, well, why do I need to go? They're gone. I mean, I can now communicate with them because now they're everywhere, so to speak. I mean, depending upon your philosophical bent. What is your perspective in that process? Is that extremely important that, hey, you need to commiserate or you need to connect with those who are left behind, your siblings or spouse, their spouse or friends or what have you? Or are you then going to be thought of as an outcast because, well, you didn't come to mom and dad's funeral, you know, and so we're going to ostracize you and, so, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, that happens. Talk to us a little bit about that kind of dynamic.
You bring up a great question. The idea of going home to commiserate is a personal decision. One of the things that often happens when we're grieving is that we're, even when we know that we have elderly parents, let's say, and that they are, you know, probably going to pass sooner rather than later, nothing really prepares us for that, the moment of that call. And even if you know it's happening, we go into a little bit of shock. It's a protection. That's the first phase. That shock and that numbness protects us from, you know, our full-on emotions. And we need that protection. It gives us a little bit of time. It gives our brain time to kind of get used to the idea of the loss. So, you know, the funeral is not really for the person who's died. It's really for the people who are living. It's a ritual. Do I believe in rituals in terms of the rituals of death? Yes, they're there for a reason. How you decide to honor a parent, go to the funeral, not go to the funeral, is certainly personal. How your family will react to that will be their own personal reaction. Being true to the self is really one of the most important steps in life, but also understanding how are you going to navigate through your family's issues if they will feel badly that you haven't joined them in their community of grief and of loss. And sometimes we make decisions, quick decisions, that later bite us only in our own minds. It's not because of anybody else. And it's good to kind of think about, well, what will I feel? What do I think I'll feel a year down the road if I don't go now? And to kind of imagine that and play it out in your mind. Again, there's no right or wrong. You know, our loved ones are in our hearts. We walk with them wherever we go. I lost my first love when I was in my late 20s. And, you know, does he walk around with me in my heart? Absolutely. He's why I do this work. So, you know, I don't have to go to the cemetery to feel him. He's with me. But everyone is different. And you need to honor yourself, but also really think about, well, you know, do I want to kind of honor this ritual?
And at least today, as we talk, and I say this in light of the fact that my parents have already sent out their last will and testament to all six of us. I was a little surprised that initially I was surprised that we received two, one from my father and one from my mother. And then I thought, well, they are individuals in general. So yes, they're a married couple, but you usually don't send out a last will and testament as a couple. And I remember reading it through, and again, it wouldn't have made any difference what they had decided. Everybody, the other five kids get everything, Richard gets nothing, would have been fine because I've said this for years. I've already gotten everything from them that I could ever possibly want. I mean, not just life. I mean, that's kind of a cliche. But the connection that we have had, especially over the last 20 years or more, I see them more as really good friends than as parents. To the point where I was actually able to share with my father when I was visiting back in on Easter, when they were taking care of their great-grandson, I was just blown away. And they were looking really haggard because this is like a 1.5, 2-year-old kid, right? And he was a little sick. And I turned to my dad and I says, "Dad, you do know that, yes, I know you love your daughter and your granddaughter as well as your great-grandson, but you do know you can say no, that we just can't take care of the kid. We're, you know, we're worn out." And he said, "Oh, I know. I says, "Do you want me to call somebody?" He says, "No, don't you get involved," and which I didn't. You know, don't need to get into that dynamic. And I'm fortunate. I've described it this way. I'm not saying that I grew up in what you would might call a Norman Rockwell type of life. It was middle class, no question. And for those of you who don't know who Norman Rockwell is, Google it. But we had our struggles and strifes, but I got to tell you, our Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners, they were really nice. We had a great time, great conversation. And when I would go over to my parents' house with my second wife and we would talk for hours about all kinds of metaphysical and spiritual things and what's going on in our lives. And it was fantastic. So I suppose you might say one of the lucky ones, but I'm wondering, I think about this in terms of grief, in terms of the, and I've been through it, and I remember when my grandmother passed away on my mother's side. I think I was 7, and I think I was also almost asked to leave the church because I was so upset. And fortunately, I guess I calmed myself down because I wasn't ushered out. But I've often thought, and I realize this is simplistic, and this isn't going to happen. Just like my first wife coming down the gangplank with the dog. If we would just not attach ourselves to people, but it isn't just people. I live here in Santa Barbara, and I have to tell you, I grieve over the fact, almost daily in a sense, on a very low burn or simmer, that the lifestyle that I came here to live over the last 11 years, I've lost. I don't feel safe here anymore. Matter of fact, I don't think I'd feel safe anywhere in California, primarily because of the risk of fires and getting burned out. I am burned out over the possibility of being burned out. So when we talk about grief, we're talking about it on a lot of different levels here.
Yes, it's so, you know, to your point, the place you live doesn't feel safe anymore. It's not what it was, and it was a wonderful respite for you, and now you're seeing that it's less of a respite. Maybe you're afraid, you're concerned, when's the next fire? Am I going to get hit the next time? And you start to, you know, really think about, project into the future, what's going to happen. And that kind of ruminating can actually cause us grief, you know, that kind of anxiety. And certainly, oftentimes anxiety, depression, even rage can often just, you know, it can be held onto its own. But then if we can look back, we can say, wow, you know what, you lost something. There was something that you really grieved, and that wasn't really handled or dealt with. And so grief is everywhere. It's in the news now. We can't seem to escape hearing about shootings and abuse that's happening to, let's say, these 150 plus gymnasts that were, you know, just now hearing their stories as they get deeper and deeper, and the grief of that they're holding, having kept secrets for so long, and then their parents who, you know, also kind of had to keep these secrets, and who knew and who didn't know, and, you know, the minds of trainers who are really sociopathic, who kind of put them under a very dark and dangerous spell, and the grief that causes, and the coming out that is needed. So we, you know, and as these stories come out, the people across the United States and even the world who hear these stories, if they have hidden something or kept something in a very secret place, all of a sudden they may get triggered. So grief and trauma can come up in ways that are so unexpected. And that's really what I talk about in the book, that it's grief. We are in its grief. It's grief. We are inundated with hearing stories that are so potent and so powerful and dark. And sometimes we get triggered and don't know what to do with those triggers. And one of the things that I suggest to people, even some like you've spoken about, you know, home is not feeling so safe anymore, is talk about it. Don't keep it a secret. Let other people know what's going on. You might find that you have a community of people who are like-minded. If what you're hearing in the news, the shootings or the abuses are triggering something in you, don't go it alone. Don't avoid it. Start to think about it. Have a voice. Write about it. Reach out to some local self-help groups. If you've got a computer, maybe find some chat rooms where you can stay anonymous and maybe hear what other people are saying. So it's grief is really that it's everywhere, and it's a dance. But once you start to go into the dance, self-reflection and self-knowledge begin to percolate in ways that, again, you cannot imagine, good ways.
When we come back from our break, we're going to talk about the 11 phases, and we'll go through them one by one and talk about them just a little bit as we go. But before we go to break, I don't know if you saw this documentary on PBS. It's some years ago, on death. And this team traveled around the world to different places to document the grieving process. And I found one in particular so profound. They went to this tribe, and I wish I could remember if it was in Africa or South America. I recall. I'm seeing the images in my head. I'm thinking maybe Africa. And they were allowed to come in. They asked permission. They were allowed to come in to watch the process after the person had passed, and they prepared the body and everyone was around it. This was what struck me so profoundly, though. At one point, the head of the tribe requested that the documentary team leave, because what was about to happen in that village was unpredictable, and that they could not guarantee the safety of the documentary team. And they left. But they were told what was going to happen. And what supposedly happened was that the entire tribe went through the grieving process and in the phase of anger and frustration and so forth. In other words, that real, potentially violent emotion, if you will. And first of all, I thought it was wonderful that they were, you know, the request was made. You know, we can't protect you. We think you should leave. And at the same time, that they were actually willing to actually have a phase in the grieving process as a tribe, as a community, where, okay, it's time now to express our anger. I realize that that isn't exactly the way these steps work. They don't necessarily come in this order. But I just thought that was a fascinating documentary about looking at the ways in which different cultures deal with death and dying. And of course, in the West, in the United States in particular, we're probably last when it comes to dealing with death in a real positive way. We almost, again, as you said earlier, we want to ignore it. We don't want to acknowledge that it actually happens.
We want to sanitize it.
Yes. Yes. When we come back, let's talk about these 11 phases. We're talking with Edie Nathan. She is the author of It's Grief, The Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. We're going to talk about the 11 phases of grief, of grieving, if you will. And we will do that.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Rubin, your host, and I thank you for joining us. I say us because I'm joined by Edie Nathan, and she's the author of It's Grief, The Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. And we're also going to talk about these 11 phases. But first, before we jump there, let me ask you why this subject, this emotion in particular, is so important to you. What happened in your life that flipped the switch saying, I got to talk about this. I've got to do something about this. I need to share with people.
I went through many different losses in my life and moments of trauma, from having been bullied to being overweight, to being sexually abused, and then ultimately losing my first love. And I was in my late 20s when I lost my first love. And I wish that I had had a guide, a book to help me really cope and with and understand what I was going through. And there was really nothing out there, especially being a younger person. The messages that I tended to get were, you know, you'll get over it. What also happened in mourning my first love was that all the past traumas that I had experienced started to come up, and they obviously had not yet been resolved. So I really started to think about, well, gosh, grief hits us in so many different ways. And it's, yes, it is the loss of a loved one, but trauma that is not dealt with, it causes grief and can really, you know, hit the body and affect the body. And certainly the weight was a response to having been sexually abused. And so often women and men who have been sexually abused will really suffer with ways to protect themselves. They need to control what's going on, whether it's I'm going to put weight on, or I'm going to starve myself, or I'm going to get into alcohol, or I'm going to do some drugs, just to calm the self, protect the self, and make the self less available. So I really wanted to have a discussion and open the conversation up about where grief hits us and how it hits us, and then what to do. And what I really have hoped to accomplish in It's Grief is that I'm a companion along this journey with you, and I'm not telling you what's right or what's wrong. I'm actually saying whatever you're going through is right for you, and you're going to have ups and downs. And there are self-assessments in this, and knowing who you are. Like I talk about, are you an extrovert? Are you an introvert? Are you an ambivert? And knowing, you know, gosh, you know, I cope by being more alone, or I cope by being in a crowd, or I can actually kind of go between both, can help you navigate the kind of help you need. And that is, I think, an important self-assessment, because it helps you help yourself. And that's really what I want people to be able to do, is help themselves through this.
Yeah, but I want somebody to tell me what to do.
This is too hard.
It's too hard.
Yeah,
for some folks, it is hard.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? This isn't easy. And it's my book cover is actually a picture of a figure that's jumping off of a cliff, mm-hmm. and jumping into another person's hand. And it's actually a picture that reminds me of the tarot, of the Fool's card. And the Fool is actually very bright and has a lot of curiosity. And really, in this journey, one needs to take a leap of faith. A leap over the vortex, over the depths, over the darkness. And that hand can be the hand of a therapist, a friend, a family member, but that hand also needs to be your hand, so that you catch yourself. And that is part of this dance of self-discovery, that you have yourself. And as much as you don't want to take that leap of faith, as much as you would just rather avoid it, avoiding it makes it bigger. And we know that, we can see that in anxiety. You avoid it, try to ignore it, and it just gets bigger. Anger, avoid it, quiet it. It just gets bigger. When you start to recognize it, honor it, then it actually quiets. And you have an opportunity to actually quiet the self.
I've also found, too, that this is just for me. I don't know if this necessarily applies, but I always found, too, that when I'm dealing with whatever it is that I'm worrying about, thanks to my Irish heritage, nighttime is the worst time to deal with stuff, because nighttime, it's dark, there are no boundaries, and whatever the problem is, whether it's, you know, grief or I'm dealing with my finance or what have you, it's huge, it's enormous, and that I have to find a way to quiet my mind until sunrise. Because when the sun rises, now it's the light of day, the light is now shining upon the problem, and it's not so big. And so we need to find a way in our lives, whether it's day or night, to have the sunrise. If that means, again, as you've quite eloquently put it, have somebody that you can touch base with. The only time that I can consciously remember ever not having any fear was when my wife and I both lost our jobs. Now, it was interesting because, first of all, I knew mine was coming because the station was being sold and we were all being let go. And we were told when our last day was. But my wife was very worried. She's very concerned. And I remember thinking and sharing with her at that time, I said, well, I've been through a lot of workshops and seminars. I've interviewed hundreds of people up to that point. And I said, the only advice I've ever been given that applies here is that when you come to the edge of a cliff, she used the word precipice because that's how she felt, that we were on the edge of a precipice, you jump and you trust. And your drawing, your picture, your painting on the front cover of your book, It's Grief, basically is saying that you need, in this case, he's not jumping, but nonetheless, stepping out and trusting this outstretched hand, whether it's another person and or himself or herself. And that's, again, it's a hard one. It's a hard one because we are, especially men, are taught to, well, man up, you know, suck it up and just keep going forward. I don't care if you broke both your legs and your wrist is blah, 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 blah. Suck it up and get the job done. We don't have time for this. And I'm noticing that in our society here in the West, that's across the board, men and women now. It's got to get the job done before you. And I do have to tell you that my very first general manager told me, if you ever feel like panicking when you're working on whatever it was, and also reminding me that it wasn't brain surgery and nobody's going to die because it was radio. She says, if you ever feel like panicking, all right, hold on to that. Just don't dive into it. Resolve whatever issue you're dealing with, okay? And once it's resolved, you can go over in the corner in a little puddle and you can panic. And that was her suggestion. Now, she wasn't being mean or cruel or anything. It was just convert that energy into something productive. She wasn't saying you couldn't panic. She was just saying, hold it until you get to a place where it's a little more appropriate. Should we be doing that with grief?
You know, it's such an interesting question, because the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no. There are going to be times when you're feeling that anxiety and, you know, it's so overwhelming, or you just want to cry, but you're in the middle of a meeting and you can't do it. And in those times, I suggest people, oh, you know, like create a beautiful box in your brain, and let that be your cry box, and let that be your anxiety box. And when you're in a place that's not appropriate to experience those tears or to experience that anxiety, and it's not easy to do necessarily, but put the anxiety, put the tears into that box, and make sure you make a date with that box, with what's inside that box later on, and pay attention so that you're not avoiding it, but you at least are honoring it. But you know that if you were to go into your anxiety or into your tears in that moment, that you would, the shame that you might feel, the embarrassment that you might feel, or the sense of overwhelm may be so great that it takes you into another dark hole. So it's actually learning how to kind of control your impulses a little bit. Now, anxiety, you know, and someone who has anxiety, and I certainly have suffered from anxiety in my past, it's not easy to just quiet it or soothe it. And exercises actually are given throughout my book, It's Grief, on how to help calm the anxiety, how to nurture it. And one of the biggest things is to acknowledge it, and even to acknowledge it if you're with people who you know, who are friends, and you start to feel that anxiety, you can say, you're not going to believe this, but I've got, you know, right now I'm feeling like a little nervous, and I just wanted to let you all know. And you might realize that even by bringing it up, it calms it down. It is in the nature of hiding it that it grows. It gets bigger. It grows legs, and it becomes this untenable monster. And if you bring it out to light, and you say, "Oh, okay. Well, you know, I actually it's okay, and I'm going to get in touch with my breathing." And one of the ways, again, to help with the anxiety, because our breathing when we're in an anxious state becomes very erratic. And it often feels that we can't catch a breath. And we, especially when you're grieving, it's like anxiety is very intense for some people, not all, is to hold your breath, which is exactly counterintuitive. But the message that we give ourselves is, oh my God, I'm not breathing, I can't catch a breath. If you hold your breath, if you weren't breathing, you wouldn't be able to hold it. So hold it. Mm-hmm. And hold it for 30 seconds and then let it go and then hold it again. And then let it go. And you're telling your brain, oh, I can breathe. I am breathing. Mm-hmm. And that calms you down. It actually calms you down.
What's interesting also for me is the experiences and awarenesses that I have had at the times of the passing of different individuals. With one, I felt I was at the memorial service at the church. And I just was kind of looking around because of where I was philosophically at the time and thinking, wow, he's all around us right now, you know? And I felt good about that. With my dear friend who passed away in our home, I was mad and angry because primarily, not only just because of the loss of the friendship that my wife and I had with him, but because he was going to teach me a lot about cars that I did not know. Now, I was in my 30s at the time. I didn't grow up with cars because I was legally blind until I was 38, so there was no car. It was a bicycle. And I was really upset about the fact that I wasn't going to get that opportunity to learn from him about these cars because he was so meticulous. He was so good. The dinners that we used to share. When my grandmother passed away at the age of 7, it was very traumatic because I was very close to her. And a few years later, I had a dream about her, which was very interesting. So obviously our reactions to different people in different situations as well, you never have the same reaction to grief every single time. So there is no formula per se, but you have the 11 phases in your book, It's Grief, The Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. Let's start with the emotional armor in terms of numbness, hysteria, denial, and protest, as well as shock. And to me, shock would come first because you get the news. Like when my grandfather passed away, my dad was on the phone and he gets off and I just come home from delivering newspapers and collecting money. And he says, your grandfather just passed away. And it didn't really, I mean, I was sad, but it didn't hit me the way it did when his wife passed away a few years later. you know, but we went to the funeral. He was a cowboy. He was also a sheriff in a small town. So they did the usual putting the boots in the stirrups backwards as they went with the procession down the street and so forth. But let's talk about this emotional armor. Is there a big concern? And in your practice, have you come across this where sometimes people get stuck in one of these and they need a little help, a little push to move forward? And again, this may be counterintuitive to what you've said in terms of allowing ourselves to go through the process and the steps, but can we get stuck or is that not being stuck? We're just not finished.
Good question. And both are true. Sometimes we do get stuck and sometimes we're not finished. Sometimes the two go hand in hand. You're stuck because you're not finished. Other times you can get stuck and it's how you need to self-identify. It's safe for you to stay there, to move beyond, or to start to feel the anger or the regret or the sadness would mean that you're moving, you know, you're moving out of what could be a safe zone. So emotional armor, that first phase is actually a very safe place to be for many people. The numbness, the hysteria, it's not really written in any order of mm-hmm. experience. Everyone experiences it differently.
Right.
I see the emotional armor phase as a place that no matter what phase you're in, when you're moving through a new phase and you start to have insights, that you will go back to that emotional armor phase. You may go back into numbness as you are growing, as you're shifting, as you're changing. It's kind of a resting place. You might go into denial, but denial might not be of the loss of your loved one, but denial that there's even any anger or that there's any rage or that there's any, that you have any feelings about what's gone down. So this is a resting place. This is a place that you can repair. This is a place where sometimes you just need to feel nothing, where you need to feel the hysteria. Again, it's not for me to say it's right or it's wrong. I in my work, I have always seen this circular route where when people are going through the different layers of the phases, that they will often go right back to the emotional armor to kind of create some safety for themselves. And then they are able to move on. If they get stuck in the numbness or they get stuck in the shock, I'm gonna look for other reasons that may contribute to the numbness that is lasting so long that it's interrupting their ability to navigate through the other phases.
Talk to us about role confusion. And again, folks, yes, there are 11 phases, but not necessarily in any particular order. What about role confusion?
When we lose someone, we lose a parent that we have perhaps been a caretaker of, and now we're no longer the caretaker, oftentimes we will say, who am I? Who am I now that I'm not this caretaker? Or who am I now that I have lost my spouse? Or who am I now that I don't have a job, or that I've lost a limb, or that I realized that I was adopted and that I have a birth mother? Who am I? And this role confusion is often very much part of the grief conversation. And it is also part of self-discovery, because the more role, we all have roles. We play many, many, many roles. I'm talking to you right now and I'm in one role, and I go into work as a therapist and I am in the role of therapist. And I am married and I then am in role of wife. And these roles are always, we're moving in and out of them. So when we lose our identification with a role, or where the person who we associated that role to is no longer around, it is confusing. And what I'd like to address is, what are you going to do about who you now are, and who do you want who do you want to be, and how can you integrate your sense of self into this grief conversation?
Talk to us about the three D's.
Distraction, depression, detachment. There is nothing like grief to make you feel distracted. You know, I know when, I mean, I have a funny story, and, you know, we do have funny stories even when we're grieving. When I lost my first love, I live in New York City and I take the subway, and I had actually put on two different shoes. And I was a completely, I mean, it's funny. And it was funny even then. It was like, I'm not present. I am so distracted that I put on two different shoes. And I didn't even know it. I wasn't aware of it until I looked down and I go, oh my God, like, what did I do? How could I have done this? But, you know, and that's a little distraction, but the distraction of actually the distraction really affects our sleep. It, you know, you brought up sleep. We're distracted. We can't think. We can't calm ourselves. And our minds are constantly working through what could I have done? What could I have done differently? How am I going to, you know, exist with a missing leg? How am I going to re-enter the world after coming back from Vietnam or from, you know, Afghanistan? What am I going to do? So that is certainly it's a not knowing and depression is that darkness, that deep hole, that sense of I don't want to eat, I'm eating too much, all I want to do is sleep, I don't want to talk to anybody, I feel alone, I feel that I can't do this, I don't want to live. And that is the depression. And then there is detachment, and there is actually healthy detachment. I can't be around certain people right now, they're triggers for me, or the detachment of the grief that's just I don't want to share what's going on, and maybe you're more of an introvert, and so you decide to just kind of go through this a little bit on your own first, and then reach out to one person who can help. So again, not everybody's going to go through this, and it's you're going to maybe touch upon one of these three D's, all of them, or none of them.
Yeah.
Now, the next four are some very interesting combinations of emotions. You have fear and anxiety. You have anger, rage, and despair. You have regret, guilt, and shame. And you have sadness. And those are four different sections there, folks, not one. And the one that really struck me was when I read this, regret, guilt, and shame. And I thought, wow, those three really do go together. They fit like a glove, one inside another almost. There's almost like layers there. You know, we may not have said what we wanted to say. We never told. The last words I said to Pop were, you're an idiot and I hate you, you know. And then you feel guilty for that. And now you're feeling ashamed because you didn't really get to tell your Pop that you loved him, that kind of stuff. What about all, I mean, and these emotions, they're all spinning around inside of us at that time, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're all spinning around. But again, you know, some people may not feel that anger, rage, or despair. They just might not. And some people might. And, you know, that is the beauty, I think, of the five phases, because you will certainly move in and out of them. And you might find that not in the moment, but a year down the road, 10 years down the road, all of a sudden you're starting to feel something and you thought it was closed. You thought it was over. And it's not.
That's what I hate the most.
Yeah. And one of the things that I really, you know, want everyone to understand is respect whatever you're experiencing. Yeah. You know, respect your anger's capacity to, you know, to help you heal. You know, anger is is certainly can be a contributor to losing yourself, you know, getting lost in the anger, getting lost in the rage, and almost identifying solely as this very angry, rageful person. And, you know, understanding that, you know, anger and rage doesn't have to look explosive. It can also just be an internal process, and you can have the mask of happiness and just look, you know, I'm fine, you know, which we often do. But underneath the I'm fine is that rage, that anger. And it can make us sick, it can really make us physically sick if we don't look at it. So
and that's been the conversation we've had on this program time and time again when it deals with our own personal health and well-being, is when you hold these emotions in, you're going to do yourself more physical, not just emotional, but physical harm over the years than anybody else, especially when it, let's just say, when it comes to anger and frustration towards another person. You're not hurting them. And this, I have to say, this was a great comedic line in a program once where this one character had a real frustration with a second character, you know, and he says, the second character says to the first, he says, are you thinking about me right now? Are you frustrated? And da 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 da. He says, yeah. I says, great, because I'm living rent free in your head, was kind of the phrase. And in a way, that's what we do. We allow these people to live rent free in our minds, in our frustration, in our emotions, and it's not hurting them because they're not having to pay for it, but we are. And it's really a struggle. Now, I like the next four that we go into because they begin the process of bringing us to that place of balance, of healing. We have forgiveness, letting go with insight, purpose, and understanding. That's all in one. Repatterning, calibration, and integration, also in one. Support and support groups. That's going to be an interesting one because a lot of folks, they're familiar with whatever it is, anonymous groups. I don't think there's a Grievers Anonymous per se, but looking for some group that you can sit down. I know hospice, they have available free support and so forth. And of course, number 11 is grace. And I'm actually going to have you jump to that one first and talk about grace.
So what I say in the book is, in its grief, grace lends a certain dignity to the phases and gives the dance a special beauty. And it transforms past pain into present pleasures with fluidity, calm, and serenity. And what is grace? You know, grace is not this is over, this is done. It's actually, I'm living with this, but it's not interrupting my joy, my ability to work, my ability to have a relationship. You're living with your grief in grace. Mm. And grace is beauty, it's divine, it's surviving, it's positive, it's all of those things. And it can be spiritual, it can be godly. It's not meant to have a religious connotation. It's just meant as a peaceful place, a place of internal peace.
You know what came to mind as you were sharing that? Are you familiar with a piece of material that's corrugated plastic or could be corrugated metal? If you were to lay it down, it has these hills and valleys, hills and valleys, hills and valleys, right? And if you take those hills and valleys out, of course, you have a flat piece of metal or plastic. But the corrugated material is a rather durable, strong piece of material that you can use for a lot of different things. And in a way, what you're describing as we talk about all of these different aspects, all of the 11 phases, is that in order for us to be a whole human being, we need to have all of these parts, preferably not getting stuck in any one of them. But without all of them, especially if we look at our past, we wouldn't be the person that we are today. And in a manner of speaking, we wouldn't be whole. I'm not even sure that's whole in a different definition. Not in terms of I am fixed. I don't need any more therapy anymore because I am now living on a higher plane of existence, you know, kind of thing. But whole in terms of I am me. I'm able to process these things and work through them. I may spend 10 months in fear and 6 days in frustration and anger and a week and a half in guilt.
That's right. And you may find that they're layered and that, you know, you're feeling guilt while you're feeling the anger and you're feeling the despair, but you're also starting to feel some sadness. And sadness is sadness in that phase of sadness. We can live with sadness. It's really hard to live our lives in anger or rage or anxiety. It's really hard to do that, but it's less hard. It's far less hard to live in sadness. We can certainly live in sadness.
Yes. And I have to say that there are times when I'm sitting around and I'm thinking about my life and, there's part of me that thinks that, well, you know, I'm sitting now in a place of grief, of loss, of the kind of life that I thought I was going to live when moving here. But when I look back at that moment when I told my wife that we're on the edge of a cliff and we're going to jump and trust, and we did, and boom, here we are. Well, these are just phases.
Nothing's permanent.
That's right.
And, you know, who knows how much longer we'll be here? We could be here another 20 years.
Or,
that's right.
Or 20 days. I'm curious about, I know you have an MA, an LCSWR. What in the world is that?
It just means that I'm a licensed clinical social work, and the R is kind of a designated an initial that lets you know that I've been in the field longer than 6 years. And that's really what that is. Yeah.
You are also a licensed therapist, AAS. Or ASEC?
So ASEC, I am a sex therapist. I am a certified sex therapist. And because I work so much with sexual trauma, also sexual issues, that certification, though I did it a little bit later in life, was really important because I see how, you know, so many sexual issues can cause grief and keep us down and keep us not living the lives we want to lead. So each of my case studies in the book, you know, are very different. You know, they go from sexual issues to the loss of a spouse, to the loss of a limb, to the adoption triad, because I want everyone to understand that you're going to go through your own grief, and it's grief. But it can be anyone's story.
But you're also a hypnotherapist as well.
Yes, I am. I'm a hypnotherapist, and I actually did some training with Brian Weiss in past life regression. So I do regression work as well. I really try to combine, you know, a lot of my own different tools to help people, because what one person needs is what they need, and another person has individual needs in terms of how I can help them and how they can help themselves.
And EMDR?
EMDR is actually to help people work through trauma. It has been used for the survivors of wars, for the Oklahoma City bomber survivors, and it is actually an eye movement exercise that is led by a therapist to help you change the thought process that's going on in the brain. And our brains are our best friends in healing.
And it's to me interesting, and normally I don't go through the list of degrees and things with our guests. I let our listeners go to the website, but I just found it fascinating because you, as you say, you have incorporated so many different, I use the term modalities.
Modalities.
I'm curious, one modality we haven't talked about yet, I want to throw this in because I'm curious as to how your intuition plays into the work that you do.
It's always there. And I believe that we all have intuition. You have it. We all have it. How we decide to access it is another conversation for sure. That intuition is working on so many different levels. My sense of smell, what I'm seeing, and what I might be even tasting in my mouth. And if if I allow myself to really just sit with someone and let my body feel whatever it's going to feel in the presence of that person, my body and my mind actually speak to me and let me know something's happening here. And it feels hot, it feels cold. And I can then use that information and ask questions based on that information that I'm getting. And I might not say I'm getting hot or cold, but you know, I will certainly ask them to go into their bodies and I will ask them to use their five senses to describe what's going on. And my intuition is a powerful tool. I think that people who have suffered abuse and gone through early traumas, that their intuitive skills are sharp. And the more that someone has dealt with early on in life, the sharper that those intuitive skills are.
Now, one of the things you mentioned in your own life, I have not experienced this myself, but I've been around long enough to know that when women in particular, but men as well, who have been through traumatic situations and start putting on the weight, that is a form of, in one sense, it's a form of protection.
Very much so.
And when I see people, and I'm not even speaking to the issue of obesity, because that's a whole nother thing too, but when I see different people in different circumstances, and they're very large individuals, you know, one of my first thoughts is, not that it's any of my business, but I wonder, they've obviously been through some kind of trauma. You know, they've been through something pretty horrific that they've felt the need to put on that protective layer. But they're more concerned about protecting themselves than they are about their own personal health at that point, because that's where they are.
I don't think it's so conscious.
No, it is not. No. It's an unconscious thing that's happening. And that's the reason why. And then the other thing, too, that I find interesting, too, is when we get stuck in a lot of these things and we do these kinds of destructive things to ourselves. And again, most of the time, it's unconscious. We get so distracted from what it is that we could be doing. I mean, this program is about giving people choices and knowledge of those choices to help make their dreams come true. But if you're stuck in this or that or the other, you're stuck in the grief, you're stuck in that, again, those different emotions, boy, you know, it's like you said before, you know, grief, darn tootin', it distracts you. And it'll distract you from pursuing those things that you'd rather be doing than whatever it is that you're doing now.
That's right.
Through no fault of your own per se. Mm-hmm. But I guess the first step on the road back is becoming aware that, oh, I haven't looked in the mirror in a long time. My goodness, this is something I need to deal with this, you know, and try to fix this.
And sometimes it doesn't happen until a health scare occurs. And
yeah,
it's that health scare that actually prompts them to do something about it. And then some folks, you know, they just can't. They need to stay in their protection. Mm-hmm. And you know we've heard of people who get the surgery to tie their stomachs, and they eat through them, and it's just that they're not ready. They think they want to be, you know, that they want to be thinner or that they want to get healthy, but their brains are saying it's too scary. It is just way, way too scary. And that is a form of grief for sure.
It's just amazing to me what we go through, sometimes what we put ourselves through. And yeah, there may be some truth to the old adage, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But, I'm not a fan of the trauma and the drama. And maybe that's an avoidance reflex on my part, because I went through the whole bullying thing too when I was growing up. But instead of some of the other methods, I learned to run. I did real well in track and field. And so I managed to stay one step ahead most of the time. But it wasn't a lot of fun, but it's also made me the person I am today. So I can't remove that valley from the corrugated sheet and still be the person that I am today.
That's right.
And so for people who are hearing this program, who have gone through these processes of grief at some level, or they feel maybe that they're stuck. And again, when we talk about grief, we're not talking about any specific event that's happened. It could be anything that you're grieving. As I described earlier, the grief of the loss of the way I felt when we first moved here to Santa Barbara. It's not the same. First step is to realize that, hey, you're here, you're alive. And if you want to stay alive for a good long time, see, I have to outlive my great-grandmother. She lived to 100 years of age. And from her age of 95 to 100, I was always telling people at family reunions, I was going to outlive her, but she was making it really hard. And so I've still got 42 years to go. I'm 58, and so I've got at least 42 years, another lifetime. And so I'm doing all that I can to try to stay healthy and well and well-adjusted and all of those good things, and not irritate other people to the point where they feel like, you know what? I'm taking you out, buddy.
Absolutely. And you know, just in terms of this whole grief conversation and healing and what healing is, and I'd just like to leave your listeners with this idea. And it's a quote by Akshay Dubey. And the quote is, healing doesn't mean the damage never existed. It means the damage no longer controls your life.
And that's a big difference. Big difference. Edie Nathan, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It's been a pleasure having you here. I want to remind our listeners that you can go to her website, which is edienathan.com, and that is edynathan.com. You can check out the work that she does and maybe get in contact with her if you think she might be able to assist you to work through a process or two. I would assume you do that phone or Skype or that kind of thing. Are you doing those kinds of things online?
Yes, I actually do intensive weekends and week-long for people who really want to kind of look at their grief.
Okay. It's Grief, the Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. That's the title of the book. And we encourage you to check it out, to pick up a copy as well. And I would say read the book. If you need to jump to page 157 to review, please do so, because I think it will assist you. I want to thank you so much, Edie, for joining us here on the program and for sharing with us both your story as well as the work that you're doing through this this particular book in terms of its grief. And should you ever find yourself, I've never been able to get the mileage down, 5,000 miles to the west, or I don't know if it's 3 or 5, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Oh, I would love that. Yes. Thank you so much.
I've only been in New York once. It was back in 1993. Just so happens we were standing in Central Park on Earth Day, and a very large crowd was headed our way, and we had to hightail out of Central Park
didn't get mobbed. But it was a great time.
And so maybe, who knows, maybe if we make our way out there. My wife, she just wants to fly out there and go to either Carnegie Hall or Madison Square Garden for an event, or even Broadway to see a play. Even if it was, we'd fly in the morning and get there, go see the play, and then fly home. She, you know, it wouldn't matter to her.
I love it.
You know,
what a great idea.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, I have three final questions for you. And again, thank you so much for the time. First question is, who is Edie Nathan?
I'm taken aback by the question. Who is Edie Nathan? I am a woman who's known my own grief and learn to live with it, and have learned to really enjoy life, even as grief walks next to me.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to get the conversation out there that we don't have to hide our grief, that we can start talking about it and not avoid it, but make it our greatest teacher.
And what is your life's purpose?
To teach, to be generous, and to know that we are all sacred human beings, and to appreciate the ups and downs that friends, family, loved ones, and people I don't even know go through.
Edie Nathan, again, thank you so much for joining us. And a reminder to our listeners, the website, edienathan.com. We, of course, will be linked to the website and the title of the book. It's Grief, the Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. Again, Edie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.